Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Dugout Debate Podcast. I'm Tim Hustlebury.
And I'm Chris Kerr.
This week, an epic battle will take place. In light of the 12 days between the day of recording and Christmas Day, we'll do a Top 12 Sporting Moments special. We've both written down our personal Top 12 Sporting Moments and battled to have each put into the Hustlebury and Kerr Hall of Fame. We hope you enjoy. Okay, Chris, so what's your number 12?
So my number 12 is LeBron James's first title with the Cleveland Cavaliers, or only title as it is, last year in 2016, which he ended the 52-year Cleveland sports curse, as it was called, where no team in Cleveland, no sports team had won a title, national title, in 52 years. And he managed to go and beat the Golden State Warriors in the 2016 NBA season to finally bring home a title to his hometown club. He'd won two previous titles with the Miami Heat in 2012 and 2013. But obviously, it does mean more when you're winning it for your hometown club. And he'd been with them from 2003 to 2010, then had a short stint at Miami and then come back. And it meant that he played in... I think it was five consecutive final series, which is an incredible stat on its own. But he is, I have to admit, I've got a bit of a man crush on LeBron James. He is one of my favourite sporting stars across the globe. So to see him manage to achieve something that he'd been working hard for so long was absolutely epic in my eyes. And I was very close to going for his first ever title in 2012 because... he'd been working his socks off for his entire career to try and get that first NBA title because, boy, did he deserve it. He'd been one of the top guys in the league for so long. But obviously, he wasn't going to get the recognition. His name wasn't going to be put up with the likes of Michael Jordan if he didn't actually get a title during his career. So it was fantastic for him to get that first one. But this one seemed to be more special to me. I think it was an incredible final series on its own. So... to give some background to people, Cleveland actually went 3-1 down in the seven-game series. So they had to win all of their remaining games to actually win it. And their first two games actually against the Golden State Warriors were massive blowout losses. So they must have been so demoralised at that point. And to be able to turn that around, and a lot of this was largely down to LeBron James himself, he got a massive 41 points in two games, in games 5 and 6, leading the Cavaliers to two consecutive wins and stave off elimination, and then posted what's called a triple-double, so where he's got stats in assists and points and steals above 10 in those different stats categories. So it's absolutely incredible that he managed to do that in such a big game. And also there was one particular moment which was really memorable, one chase down block on a guy called Andre Iguodala in the final 2 minutes, where he went into beast mode, I'll be honest, to bring it home for his hometown club. So yeah, that is my first one.
Well, yep, that sounds pretty epic. I'm not going to lie, my basketball knowledge is pretty much zero. I know who LeBron James is, I know Steph Curry, I don't know, Michael Jordan. And that's as far as it goes. So I can't really contribute to that, I'm afraid. So what I'll just do is I'll jump straight in with mine. Mine was the Lions tour from this very year, 2017, which I think we can all agree was quite an epic in terms of the emotions for both Definitely. Sets of fans, both the Lions fans and the New Zealand fans. For anyone who doesn't know, the Lions tour is where English, Irish, Scottish and Welsh super team effectively goes down to one of the Southern Hemisphere teams, so New Zealand, South Africa or Australia, to basically fight out over a test series. This time it was New Zealand, who are regarded as the best team in the world and have been for some time. They are just incredible. They have so much weird strength and depth, despite the fact that it's basically a few guys and some sheep and a couple of rugby posts. But so yeah, the Lions lost the first match in the tour, but then they won the second quite stunningly, and then in what can only be described as squeaky bum time for basically 80 minutes for every set of fan, it sort of it sort of ended a bit weirdly in a draw.
Yeah.
That hardly ever happens in rugby. Usually a drop goal wins it, or, you know, if it's a knockout tournament, then it goes to overtime or extra time, whatever you want to call it. But in this, because it was a test series, it just finished as a draw. So the whole series finished as a draw. And it was just sort of like, oh, okay, well, that's the end of that then. And it was just, I think the damp, scribbiness sort of nature of it actually made it a lot more special to me than potentially if we had won it. But that's what I'll nominate as my number 12.
Yeah, just to give a little bit of more background on that and why I think that's really special as well, is that it was the British and Irish Lions' first win over New Zealand since winning back in the 1993 tour, and it was also their first win over New Zealand in the professional era. So I think that was absolutely incredible, and the British and Irish Lions ended New Zealand's 47-match home winning streak, giving them their first loss since losing to South Africa in 2009. So to achieve that as a feat, as you mentioned, they're widely regarded as the best team in the world. They are number one in the world rankings.
Is it really their first loss?
Yeah. So,
I swear England beat New Zealand with Marnie Tuilagi or something.
On home soil, sorry.
Oh, on home soil, okay. Yeah. Okay, cool. So, Chris, what I'm actually going to do, just because I'm such a nice chap, I think yours is a bit of a better story. I just think the big star going back to his hometown and dragging them to a title is a bit better than four whole countries taking on some sheep and just about drawing. So I'll give you that one. That
Thank
can
you.
Be number 12. What should we call it? LeBron dragging Cleveland. Sweet, that's our number 12. Right, Chris, tell me about your number 11.
So my number 11 is the 2008 Formula One World Championship, where Lewis Hamilton won his first driver's title, and he won it by just 1 point by overtaking Timo Glock on the final corner of the final lap of the final Grand Prix of the season to claim the required fifth place finish that he needed to win it. So that was really stood out in my memory as a youngster watching that. Formula One isn't one of my favourite sports, but that was one hell of a moment, and just to win it at the death like that, that really stuck out in my mind.
So, I do have that, but it's actually a little bit higher up for me. That's my number 9, spoiler alert. So, I totally agree. That essentially exactly the same reason as what you gave. It was just, I think it was because it was a major British sporting win, of which at the time we hadn't had a lot. I mean, we're kind of used to Olympic success and Murray doing so well, and, you know, our football. Football, maybe not. But you know, we've had quite a lot of sporting success in sort of the years after 2008. But that was sort of the next major thing that we did. Before all this sort of happened. And I really remember just being sat on the floor in my lounge just watching Hamilton. I don't know how it happened. It was just ridiculous.
It was
literally the final corner of the final lap of the final Grand Prix in Brazil. We've both nicked that from the same Wikipedia page, evidently. we finished fifth and beat Master the title. But, oh, it was crazy. Like, you can't script it, but it happened. So, I don't know what we do if it comes higher in my list.
Well, it's going to have to go on the list somewhere, so we might have to debate further down whether it's going to go at 9, I think. Did you say you had it, or 11?
Well, we'll both agree that it goes in.
It's definitely going in. What is your 11th place then, Tim? And we can try and we'll see what that is.
There were sort of a couple towards the end of the list, which I threw in thinking that, you know, I'm happy to give Chris a couple to take some of the higher places. But we'll go for my number 11, which was actually Chris Hoy winning his 3 golds in the 2008 Beijing Olympics.
Nice.
And it was sort of it was just the dominance that he displayed during it. I mean, again, this was quite early in my sports watching days, and I wasn't really sure what was going on, especially in things like, I think it's the Kieran, that's the one with the funny bloke on the bike at the front for loads of laps, isn't it? But just watching this absolute hulk of a Scotsman with legs bigger than my entire body just walk over the opposition. It doesn't matter what they did, what tactics they employed. He was just quicker, faster, and stronger than all of them. And it was just incredible to watch. So, you know, 3 golds. It got him a knighthood, so he's pretty happy. I don't think he'll mind if he doesn't come number 11 on this. But I'd quite like to see him get in there.
So, I remember that really vividly. And the commentator's words actually stick out in my mind. Big time. It was, he's the real McCoy, Chris Hoy. he literally must have said that during every single goal that he won. But yeah, it was stunning to watch a British athlete go out and do that at that time. And I've got the 2008 Olympics as a whole down on my list.
Okay.
I have.
We might have to shove. I'll tell you what, we'll shove Chris Hoy in there at number 11.
Yeah.
And then we'll revisit the 2008 Olympics later.
Cool.
Because I don't think that's a sporting moment, being technical with you, Chris. I allowed sporting events or entire seasons, but to include an entire Olympics is a little bit much.
I thought, I thought that was going to count as an event. I'm sorry.
Chris Hoy. So I'm afraid Chris Hoy, another title goes to his name. That's number 11. Top 12 sporting moments.
You can't begrudge him.
Of Hustle, Ray and Kerr. Right. Number 10. What's yours, Chris?
So my number 10 is the Ryder Cup in 2012, which has been nicknamed the Miracle and in Medina. I remember watching a lot of this over the whole thing, and to give a bit of background so people know why this was quite so incredible. At the start of the final day's play, the US had a lead of 10-6, which is absolutely huge going into the final day, and required 4.5 points to win. Whereas Europe required 8 points to retain the title and 8.5 to win it outright. Europe went on to achieve one of its greatest ever comebacks in Ryder Cup history by winning 8 and tying one of the 12 singles matches. And Martin Keimer ended up being the hero with a 5-foot putt on the 18th hole to defeat Steve Stricker. And took the score to 14-13. And I just remember jumping up and down in my living room just as the players were on the golf course. And it was, it sounds weird, doesn't it? As a proud European citizen.
Which unfortunately, yes, no longer going to be the case.
Exactly. I was really proud to be able to do that. And the captain was Jose Maria Olazabal, and he dedicated the victory to Seve Ballesteros, which I thought was absolutely fantastic as well.
There was very much some sort of poetic, not justice, but some nice poetry going on in the way that all sort of aligned for Seve. My number 10. I'm gonna give you a little description of a person, see if you can work out who it is. A great British Olympian, middle long distance runner, very quick, often holds it going into the final stretch. Who am I talking about?
Either Mo Farah or Kelly Holmes.
Kelly Holmes, there you go. I was trying to fool you into saying Mo Farah, but unfortunately it was probably saying the middle distance that got you. Yep, so Kelly Holmes, I'm going to go specific on this one, and it was her 800-meter win in Athens in 2004 Olympics. That was one of the first times that how old would I have been? 11-year-old child that I'd ever been truly engrossed by sport. And I didn't even know it was going to happen, to be perfectly honest. My parents just called me into the room and just said, watch, we've got a runner in this that might be quite good. She's that one there. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. So I followed her all the way around. And if you watch the race, when she comes into that final bend, she's pretty much neck and neck with another runner. And they battle out the whole way down the straight. And then Kelly just edges forward. And for the final 10 metres, you're like, yes, she's got it. And then all of a sudden, three other runners just come steaming out of nowhere. This is just from my memory. I haven't looked this up or anything. But they just come steaming out of nowhere. Everybody but her essentially knows that she's won it, even though it was only by a hair's breadth. And just that look on her face, I think everyone knows it if you know the story or if you've seen the pictures. That look on her face where her eyes suddenly become the size of planets as she realises she's won Olympic gold. It's just one of the most special moments, I think, whatever, and that's why it's on my list. It's just incredible.
I do find it very difficult to argue with that one, Timmy. That very nearly made my list. And as you say, with all of the Olympics that we've done so well at recently, it kind of overshadows it a little bit, but it's looking back at that 2004 Olympics, we didn't actually have that much success going on there.
Because we were woeful, weren't we?
We were.
Rowing, basically. Yeah. Rowing and Kelly.
It really was. So,
sorry to everyone else who won medals at that.
So yeah, she really did stand out as the moment of that Olympics for any British person watching. So yeah, I definitely agree with you on that one.
So you're happy to put Kelly Holmes 2004
at number 10? I am happy to put Kelly in there.
Kelly 2004, she's on the list. Well done, Dame Kelly. We've got Sir Chris and Dame Kelly. They're really happiest they've ever been tonight.
That is the proudest moment of both of their careers. Exactly. Right there.
So, Chris, we already know what my number nine is. What's yours?
My number nine is the 2008 Wimbledon Championship men's singles final.
Oh, mate, I've got this one higher up.
It's good that we're agreeing on a lot of them.
Yeah.
But yes, so this one comes in at this point for me because, well, I am a massive Rafael Nadal fan. I'm going to have to put that out there now.
Are you?
I am. Yeah, so that might be controversial with you. You sound like you might be a Federer man.
No, sorry, mate, carry on, please.
But yeah, to give a little bit of background, it was a 4-hour and 48-minute marathon match where Nadal eventually defeated Federer 6-4, 6-4, 6-7, 6-7, 9-7 in the final. And it is widely regarded as the greatest match in the history of tennis. With the light fading at the end of the game, I can still see it as both players collapse to the floor and we get all of those flashes from every single camera that was there. It was truly epic, and I do remember sitting there engrossed watching the whole thing. So it's difficult to keep interested in a sporting event that lasts quite that long, but it had me gripped for the whole thing.
Yeah, well, it was more the sort of narrative of the match as well, because Nadal stormed into a 2-love lead. I say stormed, it sounds like he's absolutely thrashing him. He wasn't, but for the narrative of the story, we'll
compared
say
to the rest
stormed.
Of the sets he did, yeah, exactly. He actually managed to break him.
So Nadal was 2-0 up, so all he had to 2-love up, sorry. So all he had to do was win one more set. And Federer, being the graceful master of tennis that he is, he dug in, and with that, it's just so beautiful, that one-handed backhand.
It is beautiful.
My commentary is failing me, and I think it's fair enough because it's just a work of art.
It is.
Bringing it back in the tie breaks in the third and fourth, and just watching the TV and not really being able to see it yourself, and then realizing that the light is brightened on the TV set versus real life, and some of the pictures, sort of the real pictures that they gave you of not the perfect TV angle, but just sort of the grass from another angle, and you saw that you basically can't see anything. But nobody wanted it to carry over to the next morning because that would have spoiled it. And
it would have done.
This was pre-roof, wasn't it?
It was pre-roof.
It was pre-roof. So we were pretty blessed anyway that we were having a day without rain in the middle of a British summer. So we all wanted it to finish that night, and boy, did it. Obviously, you can't have a tie break in the final set, so it carried on until 9-7, and Nadal snatched it from Federer's grasp. But that aside, Federer is still the greatest, and that's the end of the conversation.
On the number of titles, that's fair enough. I'm going to give you why I love Nadal. His raw physicality and his passion for the sport. I shout Vamos along with him at the end of every single point. So I'm sold on him.
Okay, so just to rebuff that, I don't think Federer is any less passionate.
He just doesn't show it as much.
But
does he
is Swiss.
Yes.
And they're notoriously against showing any passion. They pretty much ban all traffic, don't they? They don't
it's
like
true.
Cars.
Zero emotion.
They don't like trains not running on time. And, you know, passionate Spaniards love their public transport being an absolute mess. And secondly, Federer is still a supreme athlete. He just does it with true grace and style. Essentially, yes. Nadal, I get it. Like, his left arm is a thing of otherworldliness. That is a beautiful left arm. But Federer matched him in so many games and beat him in so many games and matches without having to run as hard or as fast. But he's as quick in getting to those balls because he makes the time for himself. And it's not, well, okay, fine, I'll accept Nadal would probably beat him in a 100-meter race, but, you know, he didn't need to do that because he's so sick. So I'm just going to ignore you and just stick to my principles.
We'll agree to disagree. It's fine.
Right, so we've got a bit of a conundrum here. Shall we throw Lewis in there?
I think Lewis is worthy of going in somewhere, so I'm happy.
I'm going to put Lewis in now because I don't think he should be above that final.
Yes.
Because I just think, 100%
agree.
As a sporting event, that was a much better spectacle.
Yeah, because Lewis is further down on my list as well, so
yeah,
I 100%
exactly.
agree.
What's your number eight?
My number eight, which is going to be really niche, and you're not going to be able to, speak about it at all, is the 2006 season for St Helens Rugby League.
Okay.
So,
I was expecting Rugby League. And I'm glad it's finally come.
So both of my uncles are season ticket holders at St Helens, to give everyone a bit of background. So it's in the family, and I go up and watch them at every occasion I possibly can. And in this 2006 season, St Helens won everything they possibly could win. So they won the Super League title, which is the league championship. They won the Challenge Cup, which is the equivalent of the FA Cup, which is the knockout tournament. And they won the League Leaders' Shield, which means they finished top of the regular season and then went on to win the playoffs as well. So it was absolutely incredible as a youngster. So I was 12 at the time, to watch one of the teams that I've grown up supporting go out and win absolutely everything and be all-conquering. And actually, at the end of the season, over 50%, I think, of the Great Britain team that went on to beat Australia was made up of St Helens players. So it felt as if St Helens had gone and beaten Australia, who were the number one team in the world. So just that season really sticks out in my mind as being one that I'll always cherish and remember, that the memories from that. That was one of my sporting highlights at a young age.
Fair enough. In the context of sort of rugby league at the time, were St Helens just smashing it anyway? Were they winning titles and that sort of thing anyway? Or was this sort of out of nowhere? But
it wasn't completely out of nowhere. They had, I think they'd reached the Super League final the year before but lost it. But they'd won, I think I'm right in saying they'd won the Challenge Cup the year before as well.
Okay, all right.
But yeah, they were there or thereabouts anyway. And to give you a little bit more of a point on this, in December 2006, St Helens won the BBC Sports Personality the BBC Sports Personality of the Year Team Award. So, okay, yeah. And for a rugby league team, rugby league team to go and win that was pretty incredible. Yeah, and at the same ceremony, Daniel Anderson was also given the BBC Sports Personality of the Year Coach Award. So it was unheralded to be able to go and do out something like that. I can't remember the last time that a treble was done by any club side. It has since been done by Leeds, but before that it was a long, long time ago.
Very neatly, talking of Sports Personality of the Year Award winners, my number eight is Andy Murray winning Wimbledon in 2013 versus Djokovic. I appreciate it's another tennis one, but you know, I do like tennis. Murray had lost the year before to Federer, and everyone was expecting a difficult match against Djokovic on what was an absolutely scorching day in the middle of summer in 2013. And Djokovic, he obviously renowned for his defensive game, really fit, great athlete, and Murray is largely the same. And Djokovic had a few titles behind him, and we were all expecting, oh God, is Murray ever going to win a Wimbledon title? And he destroyed Djokovic. It was three sets. It was, you know, it was so easy. And he climbed up, we all remember when he climbed up sort of the gantry and went and hugged his mum and did all the running around. And it was the fact that it was a British athlete, even though he's Scottish, a British athlete winning Wimbledon for the first time in God knows how many years since whatever Fred Parry, a British male athlete.
Yeah.
It was sort of a year after the Olympics. We were all pretty high off that sporting event still, but we hadn't really had our appetites satiated since. And then Murray comes along and he does it and obviously wins Sports Personality as a result. And it was another time that everyone just thought, yeah, Britain's great, even though he's technically Scottish. So that's my call for my number eight.
So I had him higher on the list for me. He was on my list as well.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
God, this is all getting so confusing.
Yeah, I know. So he was at six for me.
He was at six?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Because a lot of these aren't budging for me above that.
Yeah.
I can't move them down anymore. So what should we do? So we've got number eight free. So that can either be... we've had Lewis. So that can either be Federer, Nadal, Murray or St Helens.
I think Murray's higher on the list for me than Federer and Nadal. So if Federer...
Really?
If...
Oh. I'm not sure.
It's only literally because of the British thing in there. Because I was feeling patriotic.
As a sporting spectacular, the Nadal Federer in 2008 wins hands down. Just because it was just so close the whole match. You know, it ebbed and flowed. Brilliant as Murray's was, it was a bit of a thrashing.
I was happy, comfortable.
what I would have loved even more was Murray went two sets down, it was five love down, and then came back and won it.
No, I don't think that's the true
British way. If it's going to be a British, because it's British, that's got to be the way it's got to be.
There's no way my heart would have taken that.
Yeah, but that's the point. You want to have a massive following while you're watching. But that's why sport's so brilliant. So I'm... If absolutely forced, I can let Murray go ahead, but I really don't want it to. I think the Federer Nadal has got to go higher.
Yeah, I guess it is personal opinion, isn't it? And
yeah, but this is our list.
Yeah, I know. In my thinking, it's literally gone there as a fan because I was a bigger fan of that moment than I was of Nadal Federer winning.
Okay.
So that.
But in years to come, yeah, when we get judged by the public, you know, the many millions that are going to listen to this podcast, and they find that we've put Murray ahead of that Federer-Nadal match,
that is
we'll
true.
Be berated on Twitter like you wouldn't believe,
yeah,
because we're British. And while that's a fair thing, I think as a sporting moment, as a pure sporting moment, which is actually what this is kind of meant to be going towards, I think the Federer has to win it. The Federer-Nadal match has to win it.
That's fair. I'll agree with that. I don't want to get the wrath of tennis analysts. So
no,
I'm gonna,
you don't.
I'm gonna
you don't.
Swerve
right,
past that.
So in at number eight... is going to be well, actually, we didn't actually agree. Are we agreeing that Murray's going in at number eight?
Yep, Andy Murray's going at eight. Yeah,
they've
both got to make the list. Let's be honest,
yeah,
they both
yeah,
have
they
to
do.
Be on there somewhere.
And then obviously we've got Federer and Nadal. Well, we'll call it Nadal 2008. Sweet, right. Okay, now we're getting to the crunch time. We're over halfway. How long into the podcast are we? This is going to be a long one. It doesn't matter, though, because we're all enjoying it. We've got that Christmas-y...
It's a good topic.
We've got that Christmassy spirit.
Yeah.
We're not going to do another one before the new year turns, so why not have an extra special bumper episode?
Yeah, let's give them a bumper.
Right, so your number six was Murray, wasn't it? Your number six was Murray. Right. I feel like you're going to have this one anyway, but this is where it came on my list. So Leicester City's title win in 2015-16 of the Premier League. So that's my number six. Do you have that higher, Chris?
I don't actually have that on my list, believe it or not.
You don't have it on your list. That's good, because we have got an empty spot at number six, very conveniently. So just to provide a bit of context to the goat that somehow managed to avoid hearing about this. I'm pretty sure literally everyone on the planet managed to hear about this. Leicester City in 2015-16, after narrowly avoiding relegation with quite a stunning run the previous season, relegation from the Premier League after a stunning run at the end of the previous season, managed to lift the title with a final total of 81 points, with one of the least expensive squads in the Premier League and one of the lowest wage budgets. And the bookies had them at 5,000 to 1 at the beginning of the season. Obviously, bookies odds and scientific odds are two completely different things. They weren't 5,000 times less likely than anyone else to win the title, but it was still pretty epic. I mean, literally until the day they won their title, everyone was expecting them to, you know, just go back to sort of revert to the mean, or go back to their normal ways and just be a bit rubbish. But they won it and beat off so many better teams on paper. And
it's big of you to have this on the list, Timmy, because they beat off Tottenham.
All right, you know, this is we're talking pure sporting moments. I can't argue the Federer Nadal thing higher up the list and then say because I support Spurs,
yeah,
Leicester have got to be
true,
lower.
That's true. I've got too much personal emotion invested in these things. I can't see past it.
Yeah, I did buy a Spurs shirt when it looked like we might actually win the title. I mean, I bought the Spurs shirt for that season just as we looked like we might win the title.
Oh, I
better have one that actually fits the season, but then they didn't, obviously.
That hurt in many ways, in the wallet
special.
And in the heart.
It was like 50% off, so it wasn't too bad.
Oh, it did well. But
It was also the way that night that the title was actually won. It was an infamous game, actually, between Tottenham and Chelsea at Chelsea's home ground on Stamford Bridge. And it became known as the Battle of Stamford Bridge. And my lord, was it tasty. You know, we're harking back right to the 1980s with some of the agricultural tackles that were flying in that game from Spurs. It was Spurs who were doing all this. Granted, Chelsea were sort of riling them up a bit, but it was Tottenham who were the protagonists in this particular story. And Mark Clattenburg, I think we've all seen his quotes recently, that he wanted to let Tottenham bottle the title rather than anything being blamed on him. And he thought that a few of the players should have been sent off. We all have our opinions on that. Mine is like, damn right you should have sent them off, but thank you for not doing it, because it made a complete spectacle. But Tottenham just lost their heads and well done to Chelsea with all the mind games that they launched at them beforehand.
They're very good at that.
They are. I mean, I dislike Chelsea.
Yeah, well, they've done it to my team as well. So yeah,
I think well, not many of us like Chelsea except Chelsea fans, but are there any? I don't know. So that's my number six, old Leicester City, and there is a nice empty gap on the list.
Have we missed number seven?
No, that was Nadal, Federer and Nadal.
What was number eight?
Murray.
I see what you've done there. You've put them both in.
Yeah, I
you put them both in one after the other. See, I didn't.
Okay, well, if you've missed one,
yeah, I've not given you my seven.
Give me your seven.
My seven is also linked to Leicester, so it's Man City winning the league in 2011-12.
Okay, that comes quite a bit higher for me.
Do you want me to describe it now, or should we leave that till later?
We'll leave it till later, I think.
Okay.
What's your number five?
I'm happy with Leicester going in at this point.
Okay, so your number six Man City?
My number six was Andy Murray, which we've already
done. Your number six was Andy Murray. Okay, yeah. So what's your number five?
My number five is the 2003 Rugby World Cup win.
Oh my God, Chris. maybe we should have liaised a bit about this.
We should have liaised before.
Okay, right. With this in mind, I think we're going to have quite a few of the same things.
Yes.
So what we'll do now is we'll build up to our top one.
Yeah.
So we'll just say what they are, and then we can argue up and down the list where they should go.
Okay.
Because otherwise we're going to keep running into this problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So your number five was the England Rugby World Cup in 2003. We will visit these, of course.
Yes.
Your number four, Chris?
My number four is the 2005 Ashes.
Okay. Your number three?
My number three is the 2017 Super Bowl comeback from the Patriots against the Atlanta Falcons.
Yeah, okay, your number two?
My number two is the 2012 Olympics.
As a whole. Okay, and your number one?
And my number one is Istanbul 2005, unsurprisingly.
Istanbul 2005, okay. Good. All right, so my number five was the Super Bowl 51 in 2017.
Nice.
So that's been visited. My number four was Man City 2011-2012.
Nice.
My number three was England Ashes 2005.
Nice.
My number two was Bolt at Beijing in 2008.
Oh!
Different. And my number one, if you've been listening, you'll be able to work it out. England Rugby World Cup 2003.
That's your number one.
Yeah, that's my number one. My top sporting moment ever. Right. So...
Right, we've got to sort all of this out.
Let's just
now.
Drop them down. Let's just have a bit of silence where we drop them all down. We agreed that Leicester City would go on the list at six. So Leicester City, they're six. Then we've got the top five. So Man City for you was...
Man City for me was outside of my top five, so that was a seven.
But we've both agreed it's got to go on the list.
Correct. So it's got to go on there somewhere.
So it's got to go on there somewhere. So
and it's probably got to go five, if I'm honest.
It's got to go five. Okay, so that means you're going to have to lose something from the entire list from your top five. Okay?
Holy smokes.
This is where it gets difficult, all right? So we'll agree Man City is five. We can fiddle around at the end. I think we'll come back and we can fiddle around with stuff that just gets knocked out.
Yeah.
At number 12, we have...
LeBron James winning his first NBA championship with the Cleveland Cavaliers in 2016.
At number 11, we've got Chris Hoy and his three gold medals in 2008. At number 10, we've got Kelly Holmes winning the 800 metres in 2004. Number 9, we've got Lewis Hamilton winning his first world championship Formula One title in 2008. At number 8, we've got Murray's first Wimbledon win in 2013 against Djokovic in straight sets. At number 7, we've got Nadal's Wimbledon win against Federer in the 5-set epic. Number 6, we've got Leicester City's title win in 2015-2016. And number 5, we've got Man City's title win in 2011-12. We actually haven't gone through it, so let's go through the Man City win right now. I'm sorry to everyone, this is going to be so difficult to edit, so it's going to feel a bit higgledy-piggledy, but I think you can appreciate this isn't something that we can take lightly and do on the fly like we are doing. It really needs a lot more time and thought. So heading into the final day, Manchester City had the chance to win the title, and they had better goal difference compared to their crosstown rivals, Manchester United. So effectively, all that Manchester City had to do was equal the result that Manchester United achieved on the day. Okay, so the kickoff was, they were all at the same time. So Man City and Man United at the end of that 90-minute spell would know who was the champion. So Man City had already relegated QPR. They were facing, were they already relegated? I think they were.
Yes, I believe they were.
Already relegated QPR, and Manchester United had Sunderland. I think both games you'd expect each team to win fairly comfortably. But as the game headed into stoppage time at Manchester City, they found themselves 2-1 down to a 10-man QPR. So they'd already had QPR had already had Joey Barton sent off, which, you know, obviously Joey Barton's
not
been
a
sent
surprise.
Off. As the game headed into stoppage time. As this happened, as stoppage time began, Man United finished their game against Sunderland 1-0. So they had already got the 3 points, which meant that Man City had to equal that result, which meant they had to win against QPR. So we head past the 90-minute mark, head past the 91st minute. I think it was only sort of 5 minutes of stoppage time. And in the 92nd minute, a header, I think, from Edin Dzeko gets them equal.
Yeah.
But they still have to score a winner. And then after some faffing around and some quite abysmal play from QPR, let's not forget that. the ball finds its way to Balotelli and then to Aguero! And he slams it into the back of the net and wins Manchester City the title. And I think that it has to go on our list just because of, you know, that the context of it being against their crosstown rivals, the context and how long it had been since they won their last title, the fact that it ended in the way that it did, it's got all the necessary ingredients to be a top sporting moment.
Yeah,
it's on the list. It's at number five.
A whole season goes down to goal difference. They finished on the same points. It's mental.
I know, it's crazy.
It was also quite enjoyable as a Liverpool fan to see United lose it like that as well.
Oh, 100%. But just as a sports fan, you enjoyed it, right?
Yes, of course. Okay. That was enjoyable as well.
Right, so we've got Man City at number...
This is where it gets controversial, I think.
Five. So, right. So I'm just going to cross that off my list.
Yeah.
Right. So you're going to have to lose one off of this, or we're going to have to bump something
down
later.
And it's not going to be my number five, because that's your number one.
Yeah, it's not going to. Okay. So what we've got left, the contentious issues left on both of our lists that we don't agree should be on the list, are Bolt from me. Okay.
Yeah.
2012 as an event for you. And Istanbul as an event for you. Okay, so essentially,
which one would you like me to put my case forward for first?
Let's debate. As they're similar, we'll go Bolt versus 2012.
Okay.
So give me the case for 2012 for you.
Well, 2012 obviously had a lot of nostalgia around it anyway, because it was in our own country, and to have the Olympics come to Britain was incredible in the first place. But then to have the success that we managed to achieve as a home nation as well, I thought was absolutely incredible. And it did change the British psyche for a little bit, that we actually, as you've already mentioned in previous bits, that we suddenly felt like we were better than we have been for ages. We were used to doing badly at events, and particularly when we're hosting such a big event, we thought we might be typically British and have a bit of a damp squib with some of our own performances, but it was completely the opposite. And obviously we left with a total of 65 medals, 29 gold, 17 silver and 19 bronze, finishing third in the medal table. So I think it was incredible just for that, and some of the memories personally from that. I was lucky enough to go to one of the athletics days, and I saw Jess Ennis competing at the National Stadium, and I saw Usain Bolt in some of the 100-metre early heats. So just some of the inspirational stuff of being able to go and watch it when it's on your own doorstep really hit home as one of being one of my biggest moments in sport as a spectator so far.
Okay, so this is where I think the definition of what we're doing comes into it quite a lot. I'm not going to argue with you that entire 2-week period was absolutely magical for everyone in Britain. 100%. Yes. It was absolutely brilliant. The success was, at the time, hitherto unseen from a British Olympic team. The feeling that the entire country got off the back of it was really special. I mean, it was a bit magical. It really was.
It was.
It wasn't a moment, Chris. I'm sorry. It wasn't. And Bolt getting that gold in 2008, and the way he did it with his bloody shoelaces untied and having chicken nuggets in the morning, and the time he did it in, and the way he just destroyed the rest of the field. I mean, okay, 10 seconds isn't a moment, but it's much more of a momenty moment than a two-week period.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It depends on the definition, doesn't it? Because we've got the Ashes on there as well.
I don't know what
time span we're talking about.
I think because the Olympics, we're talking about multiple events and multiple different sports, it's very difficult to condense down into one moment. Whereas the Ashes, we can sort of take it back to one test where it all sort of exploded into, oh my gosh, this is just amazing sport. Bolt, an entire sport was basically kickstarted again in the eyes of so many millions of people around the world, thanks to this lanky Jamaican bloke who could absolutely blitz it down a 100-meter track. And from that point, everyone got re-energized into the whole of athletics and track and field and the Olympic vibes and all that sort of thing, especially sort of in a British context. And 4 years later, we got the chance to do it again. And then we won loads of stuff. But I think Bolt and the legacy that he started from the second he crossed that finish line was a very definitive, great sporting moment. And even the people sat there watching, the athletes who had done it time and time again, like Michael Johnson, who, thank the Lord, works for the BBC because he's the best pundit in any sport the BBC has. He was speechless. And I think if a man like that is as speechless to a particular moment, then I think it's got to be on this list. I'm reluctant to put a whole of 2012 on it. I am willing to go back, however, and place 2012 somewhere on the list. I think it's worthy of being on the list. As a British podcast, we can pop it on there somewhere. That does mean something has to be sacrificed.
This is getting too complicated.
Okay, we'll come to a compromise. At our number 11, we can have Chris Hoy and Kelly Holmes. We'll have the Sirs and the Dames on at the same place, so we can throw it down, maybe.
You really could do a whole Olympic countdown just of
we
all
could,
of the moments,
could,
couldn't
yeah,
you?
We could. But I don't want to take them off, though. I think, okay, so Chris, I think we'll acknowledge that 2012 was amazing.
Yeah.
But I think at number 4, we'll put Bolt. Is that okay? Is that a happy compromise? Because I think it's not
me.
A sporting moment, and from what we're actually looking for in this this context, it's gotta be missed. Right, so we've done Bolt, he's on the list. We've done 2012, that's not on the list. Right, what next? Oh, so you've got to give your case for Istanbul, Chris. It's got to happen now because it's not going higher than 3. Okay. Hit me up. Just tell everyone the details.
Okay. So, as a Liverpool fan, this is why it's obviously my number one and why you're not going to have it any higher. But it's the greatest ever Champions League final. To give it some context, Liverpool ended up going 3-0 down before half-time. AC Milan were the favourites going in before the match, and they actually took the lead in the first minute through their captain Paolo Maldini. And then Hernan Crespo added 2 more goals to make it 3-0 at half-time. I very nearly didn't watch the second half of the game. I was in the kitchen sobbing with my mum, like, I'm not going to watch the rest of this. And she was like, get back in there and support your team. So
that's why we have mothers, Chris. They know
thank
best.
You forever. Thank you forever to my mum for getting me to watch the rest of the game.
What's her
but
name?
Then, Katie.
Shout out to you, Katie Kerr.
Great job. Katie Kerr, thank you very much. And then Liverpool in the second half went on to launch one of the greatest ever comebacks, scoring the 3 goals they needed in a dramatic 6-minute spell, with goals from Steven Gerrard, Vladimir Smicha and Xabi Alonso. And it ended up going into extra time, where Jerzy Dudek pulled off an incredible double save to keep us in the match. And we ended up winning on penalties, where Dudek, with his wobbly jelly legs, managed to save a penalty from Shevchenko. And I erupted crying for different reasons this time out of pure joy.
Yeah. No, it was special. I've got to agree. I can't remember. When we go and do the extra reading, I'll assume we'll do a bit. There is a really amazing tactical analysis of the game to anyone who cares about football and tactics in any way, or football. It's on Reddit. Somebody took the time out of their life to do this, but, you know, fair enough. He literally goes through how the tiny changes that Rafael Benitez made completely changed the entire game. It really is. Yeah. It's a spectacular read. I promise I'll find it. It'll take me ages, but I will find it.
That is well worth looking at. And Benitez is a boss.
Rafael Benitez being Liverpool manager at the time, obviously.
Yeah.
And how the changes from the Milan side actually inhibited them as well. It those fine margins make this even more special than the rest of it going on. I got the sense reading it, sort of, oh my word, sport at this level is just so finite, like the tiniest little things changes, thousandths of a second, blades of grass, all that sort of thing.
Ended up being the perfect storm.
Yeah, it does. However, Chris, there is quite a big issue with what the stuff that we've got left, right? We agree entirely on the next three things we're going to talk about. Istanbul is an unfortunate outlier.
It's my number one.
I know it is, mate. I know it is. I'm willing. How are we going to fix this, mate? I'm not sure.
Okay, we're going to have to go through the rest of them and see if I'm willing to sacrifice one of the others Istanbul.
You're not. You can't have one, two, or three being Istanbul. It's just not. It's not big enough for me. It would have been sort of 15. On my personal list.
15.
But the problem is, I'm not a Liverpool fan, Chris, and the majority of people aren't Liverpool fans, and I think they can accept that it's a great sporting moment.
It's the greatest Champions League final ever.
It's not as big as the others on the list. I mean, we've got the Rugby World Cup, we've got the Ashes, and we've got the Super Bowl. I will concede it can go on our list.
It's bigger than the Super Bowl for me. Do you want me to give you the reasons why it's bigger than the Super Bowl?
Okay, yeah. we'll visit the Super Bowl first.
That's quite a good clash, actually, because they're both epic comebacks. Do you want me to give you a bit of background on this, the Super Bowl, so that everyone can make their minds up at home as well?
Okay, hit me. No, I'll do the Super Bowl.
We've both
done the research, it's fine.
Yeah.
So we'll take everyone back to the distant past of 5th of February 2017, when, Trump was newly elected and Brexit was just a distant possible future. So it was actually a scoreless first quarter. In my world, the world of Tim, on actually the 6th of February, the 5th and 6th of February, I could not watch it for reasons out of my control, but I was determined to see it. So I did not watch it on at the time that it happened. But the next evening, I was going to sit down for 3 and a bit hours and watch it myself. And this scoreless first quarter happened. And I was actually in conversation with one of my really good friends, Pete, who is an American football player. And he had obviously watched it in its entirety. So the first quarter passed and I messaged him saying, oh my gosh, it was quite dull. I mean, it was obviously quite good, but I'm not new. At the time, I wasn't sort of aware of the nuances enough to get what was going on. So I was like, oh, scoreless is a bit boring. So then that second quarter happened when Atlanta got scored 21 points to Patriots' measly 3. Yeah. And it was looking pretty, wow. Okay, Atlanta are actually going to win this. Tom Brady, it was all painted as the chance for him to really become the greatest of all time, win his 5th Super Bowl and what have you.
The GOAT.
The GOAT, indeed. And then after the third quarter, there was just Atlanta effectively added another point. To their lead. It was 7-6 in the third. And at that point, the big shout out to my main man, Pete Pepe. I said to him, I can't hack it any longer. Like, I'm pretty bored. I'm not pretty bored, but, I've sort of had enough of watching it, especially if it's just going to be a total walkover by the Falcons. I said to him, I'm pretty much going to switch off. He said, oh, just keep watching for a bit. There's like a sick catch or something, I think is what he said. He didn't give it away in any way. He just told me, keep watching it. I was like, okay, all right, I'll stick with it. And then it all started happening. The comeback and that Edelman catch.
Yeah.
I just don't have physics. What? Like, how did that happen? For anyone who's not seen it, just type Edelman, E-D-E-L-M-A-N, catch into YouTube. And you will see physics literally break in front of you. I do not understand how that ball, from where it was, ended up off the floor. And in his hands and in control. I just don't get it. And that moment meant they won it. But the whole thing in my mind was a moment. And it was, that once the Patriots had that sort of game-ending drive, it was already over. Yeah. They were not winning it from that point. Once it got to overtime, there's no way the Falcons were going to win it, in my eyes.
Yeah. All momentum was at the Patriots. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And as a as a Brit who loves a comeback, that nothing was better than that. They were completely gone, the Patriots. You know, Brady looked a shell of his normal self. And then they found the chutzpah to come back from that. I've never said that word in my life. And they came back and they won that. Just incredible.
Well, obviously I agree with you, Tim, because it was third on my list as well. And it was the first Super Bowl to be decided in overtime. It was actually my birthday. February the 5th is my birthday.
I know. Well, that's why I couldn't watch it, obviously.
Yeah, I stayed up especially to watch it.
I was too busy celebrating your birthday asleep in bed.
Yeah, and I'm going to admit now that I'm a Patriots fan as well. So to experience it as someone rooting for the Patriots was absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
It does deserve to be on the list somewhere. Yeah. And just to say, I very nearly had three other Super Bowls that I was going to nearly put on my list. So honorable mentions have got to go to the 2014 Super Bowl where the Patriots beat Seattle with that last minute interception from their rookie. The 2009 Super Bowl when New Orleans turned the whole game on an onside kick, and obviously coming back from Hurricane Katrina in 2005 to go and win the NFL title was incredible. Yeah. And the 2007 Super Bowl as well, where the Giants completely upset the form books and beat the Patriots that had gone unbeaten all season. All three of those games could have easily made my list as well, but I knew I had to choose just one Super Bowl, and this is the best Super Bowl.
Well, it's got to go on the list, okay. We got to sort out Istanbul now, because the Rugby World Cup and the Ashes have both made our top five.
Yeah.
As has the Super Bowl. What are we going to do about Istanbul? I will concede it can go on the list, because you've put it up so high, it can go on the list.
What are we going to chop off?
I don't know, mate. I'm reading it. So you got LeBron in Cleveland so far, Chris Hoy, Kelly, Lewis Hamilton, Andy Murray, Nadal in 2008, Leicester City, Man City and Bolt so far. Oh, this is difficult.
Man, it's tough. Yeah, the Super Bowl's going to have to go in at this point, isn't it? So Istanbul's going to have to try and knock something else off the list.
Yeah.
What deserves to go?
Nothing deserves to go right, Chris.
No, nothing deserves true. It.
Okay, so the man who unfortunately is not going to make the cut on this list anymore is Chris Hoy. The reason being that I've banged on about moments here, and he won three golds, okay? Kelly, yeah. I've given for that moment as she crossed the line, that winning sort of 10 seconds afterwards where she didn't discover it.
Shock.
Chris Hoy was dominant, and he was meant to win those three golds. I'm going to let him slide off the list. We'll bump Lewis and Kelly down a notch, and we'll put Istanbul there.
That is very kind of you, Tim.
I'm allowing it on the list, but not that high.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Istanbul, Kelly, and Lewis.
I like that you've stick to your guns there. You've gone for it and said, that's not a moment. It doesn't deserve to be on there.
Yeah, no, I'm not a... I try not to be a hypocrite when I can. And on reflection, that's me being a hypocrite. And it means that we can have a nice little healthy discussion without the backdrop of Chris being super annoyed that his favourite moment ever had been cruelly snatched from his hands by his clearly superior sporting colleague. So, okay, right. Now it's interesting. So my order, my number three was the Super Bowl. Your number...
That was my number three as well.
My number five was the Super Bowl. Your number three was the Super Bowl. So the Super Bowl has to go in there, right?
Yeah.
Super Bowl. Okay.
I just want to say you're very lucky that I didn't put the 2006 FA Cup final on there as well. The Gerrard final was very nearly on my list as well.
But the thing is, you knew that didn't have hope in hell. I know you knew that. So
for moments as well, that probably had a bigger moment with the screamer. Nah,
that's a definite honourable mention. He can have that.
Yeah.
We should have done 25 Days of Christmas, mate.
Yeah, we should have done.
Okay, right, so the two sporting moments left are the Ashes and the Rugby World Cup. And you know where I'm going with this, Chris. You know why I considered Istanbul for being a moment.
Yeah.
There's a reason why the Rugby World Cup is higher on that list than the Ashes for me, okay?
Because the Ashes, isn't a moment. I had the Ashes at four, by the way.
Essentially, I know you didn't. I had it at three, but you had the Rugby World Cup at five. So on average, mine's better. but we're not going to talk about that. Let's talk about the Ashes first, okay?
Okay.
Chris, do you want to do? How much have you got on this? Do you want to take this?
Yes,
away?
I'll go for it.
Go for it.
Yeah. So to give a bit of context, the 2005 Ashes series. Obviously, we have this series against England against Australia, where we play 5 tests. It's held in the UK and then Australia every 2 years. How long it had it been since England had won? I don't know that.
Bear with, just got to scroll through. 1986-87 was the last time England won it, so 20 years.
There you go.
Pretty much.
That was a hell of a long time. And it was on terrestrial TV, actually, which is why it's high on my list, because I remember watching every single test on Channel 4.
I think, just as an aside, Sky and BT, production value, you're great. You've done marvellous things for the Premier League, but please just give it back to terrestrial TV. Like, yeah, this is what makes sport so good. Everyone can get involved in it. Hiding it behind a 40 quid a month paywall is just wrong at a human rights level, I'd go. You know, like the Holy Triangle, where there's, you know, you put Wi-Fi as the minimum thing that you need, right, in life.
Yes.
I'd say free sport has got to go underneath that, holding up Wi-Fi. I think free sport should be the pinnacle. Not the pinnacle, but the thing that holds everything else together.
100% agree.
Okay, fine. Pay for a TV license or have it on, you know, paid by advertising. But it has to be it. It just, we could have we're going to have a whole other podcast on this. It's happening. Right, okay. I'm actually just going to make a note of that now. Hold on. Terrestrial TV. Sweet. Okay. Okay.
So this Ashes series wouldn't have been as memorable for both you or I having it on Sky or BT. It'd have been more difficult for us to watch, and we wouldn't have been able to talk about it with all of our peers because it was so easy for everyone to watch. So that's that little bit covered. But ultimately, England managed to win the series 2-1. They lost the first test. And then in the second test, it was one of, as you've already alluded to in something we've talked about earlier, it was the moment, wasn't it?
It was.
At Edgbaston in Birmingham.
Yeah.
Where England won by just 2 runs. Australia had this absolutely incredible, it was last wicket partnership, wasn't it?
So I'll just take it back. So England were absolutely pumped in the first test. Yeah. They were beaten by 239 runs at the home of cricket. And there was so much optimism this time around because we thought, we've actually got a team here. We've got Freddie Flintoff. Yeah. We've got KP. We've got all these guys who can just go out there, take games by the scruff of the neck and take it away from the Aussies. And the Aussies, obviously, they had a brilliant team with McGrath and his excellent sort of accurate pace bowling. Brett Lee and his pace that would literally take your head off.
Yeah.
Shane Warne and his leg spin that would, I don't know, actually rotate the earth. And then all their batsmen, Ponting and Gilchrist, they had such a good team as well. So England got pumped in that first test. And then to turn it around in Edgbaston, which is one of my favourite sporting venues in the world, but just it's just so special. And to have the game ebb and flow like it did, and it looked like England would trash them, because they were 9 wickets down or whatever. And they only had the tail enders, the worst batsmen to get out. And then Shane Warne and Brett Lee had an epic 9th wicket stand before Shane Warne managed to tread on his own stumps, which is something that, if you don't watch cricket, it just doesn't happen. It's a basic error and that never should have happened. And then Casper Ritz came in and they fell just short, like 2 runs. I mean, you know, that one more run and it was a draw, is that right?
You
know, so one more run changes the entire series, but they managed to get that final wicket. And the scenes when that happened, you know, I feel it every time I say it. Like, you know that picture of Michael Vaughan with his wrists in a funny position?
Yeah.
You know the one I'm talking about where he's just sprinting off, just screaming at the sky in that stupid hat and the glasses? Yeah. It's so special. It's just amazing. So
it was an incredible catch as well to win the game.
It was
an unbelievable catch from the wicket.
It was Geraint Jones, wasn't it?
It was.
It was amazing. Hot. I need a minute. And then The third test match was drawn after another stand from Brett Lee, this time alongside Glenn McGrath. England won the fourth, and then the fifth test was drawn. But it was really that second test which was
that was the turning point,
which actually sort of destroys some of my argument for putting the Rugby World Cup ahead of it. But anyway,
so
the Rugby World Cup, well, let's go straight on to that. 22nd of November 2003, for some reason the words decided I put 2013. I definitely didn't. We were but young babbies in the world. I was 10. Yeah, about 10. You were 20.
Yeah, I was 10.
Yeah, you were 10. And it was an absolutely epic match. The two best rugby teams in the entire world basically going together head to head in the final down in Australia. And it was 14 all after 18 minutes with a sort of flatly getting a penalty late on in the match to send it to extra time. Wilkinson then got a penalty in the 82nd minute. Flatly got a penalty in the 97th. And then the minutes that followed, there were only three or so left, and after which it would have gone to a penalty shootout, which is like that. I don't think it's ever happened, has it, Chris?
I've seen one in club rugby, but I've never seen one in international rugby.
Okay, yeah. So essentially it goes into a penalty shootout, which in football, everyone who's a footballer can have a good go at a penalty. You know, it's not super difficult, but rugby kicking to the post is hard. Like, it's pretty difficult. I reckon if you just plonked any old person and said, get it through those posts, a lot of people would miss. And
not many professional rugby players practice kicking at the
exactly.
post either.
Especially guys like Trevor Woodman, who are 120 kilos. Maybe running to the ball would be a little bit of a stretch.
Exactly.
Let alone Phil Vickery and Richard Hill. You know, Lewis Moody might try and kill the ball. You know, all the sort of stuff. So that was the prospect, watching these big lads have a go at kicking. Today you would expect them all to do it because they're all really good all round. But back in 2003, if you were a prop, you were a prop. If you were a hooker, you were a hooker. You didn't do much else. You didn't kick. My God, you didn't kick. You wouldn't be seen. And then it was that build up. It was just sort of,
it was perfect phase after phase building towards it.
I think we all knew as we were watching a drop goal from Johnny was coming. It was going to be set up, and it was coming, and it was building. It was phase after phase, brilliant forward play, just getting through it, just getting those extra meters. And then it all happens. So Dawson dummies his way through. We all thought that was going to be the moment that he sets up the drop goal. It's almost, that moment was probably not better, but it's on a par with what Wilkinson ended up doing. A sort of 30 seconds later.
It definitely made it easier for him to do it
because
later.
It was such a punch in the gut to everyone, because we were all waiting for it to happen, weren't we? We were all waiting for that huge moment to happen. And he stole it from us, but he made it even easier. He made it more likely. He dangled that donut even close to your face while you're on the treadmill. Like, it's so close, you could just almost taste it, but it's not quite there yet. And then he fakes the pass and then appeals for the offside against the upcoming Australian line. And then he does it. And Johnny Wilkinson, off his wrong foot, oh my God, off his wrong foot, slots the drop goal and gets the 3 points. And then the game's effectively over. England just had to put it out after getting the restart.
Yeah, which for some unknown reason, Mike Catt decided he wanted to find territory with that kick. He could have kicked it anywhere.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So yeah, it was the fact that it was off his wrong foot. I mean, I can barely kick a drop goal off my correct foot, never mind off my left foot. And at that point, England had done absolutely nothing in a sporting context for years. Just nothing. And just as a young person entering into the sporting world, that was what really said to me, this is what you've got to pursue. This is what your life is going to be about. Never mind a career or anything like that. Just, in every single way, sport has got to be an integral part of your life. And for the next year, I would be outside the front of my house with a rugby ball, doing little grubby kicks, just pretending I'd get passes to myself, just say, Wilkinson, and like kick it about 3 foot in the air. And every time I did that, I relived that moment. And it was just so magical and special, and it drove me to do everything that I did in the future. That's why it's my number one. Not necessarily because it's the best moment in all sport ever, but because of what it led to. And while the Ashes, that moment was brilliant, the high that I got from the Rugby World Cup.
It didn't cause you to go out and play cricket every day.
Yeah, the high from the Rugby World Cup had already done that for sport for me. Like, I hadn't really watched it before, but that at that point, I was missing judo because there's no way I'm going to judo to miss the Rugby World Cup final. And it happened, and we won. My dad was in Tesco's, the idiot. Like, he went to Tesco's because he couldn't hack it. And this happened. And it was just so incredible that it's got to be my number one. And I will actually fight you to have the Ashes lower if I need to. But
yeah, I the only reason it wasn't my number one was because I'm the opposite of you. So it really made your sporting love, it made your love for sport, didn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas I think you've probably got a better memory than I do as a 10-year-old, but I can't really remember it having that massive impact on me. I just wish I was slightly older when it happened. So that I could remember it more clearly. And because I've become such a rugby nose now, I think I would appreciate it because I know more about all of the players now.
I think it was, arguably it was made more magical for me because I was so young. And because that I can see the moment it all happens. I can see myself stood there. Well, no, I can see the world that I was seeing. I can't see myself. I'm not sort of some mystic, but I can feel that moment, and I can feel just jumping around and hugging my mum and stuff and just being so happy that it happened and felt like I had won. It was the first time that I'd ever sort of projected myself onto something else, and I felt like I had won. I'm sorry that you couldn't experience that. But
there's no doubt it was special. To put it in a little bit more context for me, we had George Smith come to Wasps a couple of seasons ago, and I literally only knew him from the 2003 Rugby World Cup and a couple of other bits and bobs. But I literally remember him from that one game. And it was incredible to meet someone that had taken part in that heroic match. Yeah. It did still...
Even though he lost, didn't he, George Green?
Yeah, it did still rankle with me that it was someone involved in one of the greatest ever matches in any sport. Yeah. So it definitely did have an impact on me.
Okay, Chris, we've got to get to crunch. Which is higher? The Ashes second test, we'll specify it as the second test in the Ashes.
Yes.
Or the Rugby World Cup final in 2003.
I'm a much bigger rugby fan than I am a cricket fan, so I am going to be happy to have a rugby moment as our number one
moment.
You're
happy to concede. And I am. Chris, I'm more than happy to oblige. So there it is. The second test of the Ashes, 2005. And then obviously, at number one, in capital letters, the England win of the Rugby World Cup in 2003 with that final Johnny Wilkinson drop goal. Oh, Chris, that's been a journey.
That has
been
mammoth, hasn't it?
I would want to do every week. I just feel so happy. I'm just so happy right now, having talked about all of that. So just for one last go, just for everyone listening, and to wish everyone a nice, happy Christmas with, I'm sure, the voice that they're now absolutely sick of. We've been recording for pretty much double what we'd normally do. So it'll be LeBron James dragging Cleveland to their... What, Chris?
To their first title in 52 years in 2016.
Of the title of?
The NBA.
Okay, there we go. See, I'm probably up to speed with basketball. So at number 11, we've got Kelly Holmes and her 800-meter win in 2004 in Athens. Number 10, Lewis Hamilton in 2008 in his final corner of the final race, Grand Prix win, and then subsequent world championship title. Oh, lovely. I'm so happy talking about all this. Number 9 was Chris's Istanbul, the Champions League final, Liverpool versus AC Milan. Number 8 was the Murray defeating Djokovic in 2013 to win his first Wimbledon title. Number 7, Rafael Nadal versus Roger Federer in the epic where Nadal came out on top at Wimbledon. Number 6 was Leicester City winning the title, particularly after the Battle of Stamford Bridge, because that was pretty epic. Number 5 was Man City's win and Aguero in 2011-2012. Number 4, Usain Bolt and his 100-meter win in Beijing in 2008. Number 3 was the Patriots' comeback at the Super Bowl in 2017. Number 2 was the end of the 2005 second test of the Ashes, where England won the test and went on to win the Ashes series for the first time in around 20 years. And number 1, England winning the Rugby World Cup in 2003. Well, thank you very much, Chris. I'll put that article about the Istanbul Champions League win on our extra reading, but I'm not sure there's much else there. If you haven't seen any of this stuff, okay, fine. The LeBron dragging Cleveland to the NBA title win aside, because I haven't seen that and I've got no real intention of doing it. But the rest of them, you can all get a nice synopsis of what happened from various short videos on YouTube. Let that be our little Christmas present to you. We'll see you in the new year. We hope that you've enjoyed us, our little start over the last 3 or so months. We've got lots of stuff in the bag. There's lots of stuff, great stuff coming over the new year. Hopefully lots of nice new special guests like we've had before. Some great topics and some great discussions. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much, Tim. I really enjoyed this one.
Yeah, it was brilliant, wasn't it? Cheers, guys.